Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with the faculty of a recent Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinar on gastrointestinal cancers hosted by the University of Kentucky. At the meeting, faculty discussed the current paradigms in hepatocellular carcinoma, colorectal cancer, and pancreatic cancer. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Joseph Kim, MD, professor of surgery and chief in the Division of Surgical Oncology at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center. Listen on to hear Kim discuss the management of advanced HCC. What does the current treatment paradigm look like for patients with HCC?
HCC, a complicated disease to treat. There are medical issues that are associated with hepatocellular cancer, including cirrhosis and other risk factors that come into play when dealing with this cancer. There are important surgical issues that have to be considered. Surgical options, when they are not available, then we have to think about the medical options, which include regional therapeutic options, which include radiation therapy, chemoembolization, and radioembolization. And then finally, systemic therapies, which are more and more important for patients with HCC. So it really requires a multidisciplinary input from all of our specialists to properly manage patients with HCC. The new gold standard for management of patients with advanced HCC is a combination of atezolizumab, an immune checkpoint inhibitor, along with bevacizumab, a monoclonal antibody targeting the major angiogenesis factor, VEGF.
Could you elaborate on the categories of treatment options?
Working with one of my surgical oncology fellows from the past, we had put together a simple algorithm to follow. The first category, best case scenario for patients with HCC would be if they had disease that could undergo curative surgical treatment. And that would include surgical resection of disease, but oftentimes that's limited because of the patient's degree of cirrhosis or liver injury. The second option would be liver transplant, which would potentially treat the cirrhosis as well as cure the cancer. And ablation of the disease, which could be performed either by the surgeon in the operating room or by the interventional radiologist in the radiology department. So this would be the first category of treatments, the curative options. If surgery is not possible and the disease is advanced, but still remains in the liver, patients would be eligible for these regional or liver-directed therapies. Again, these would include chemoembolization, radioembolization, and radiation treatment, external beam radiation treatment to the tumor. And these treatments have been shown to be beneficial for patients with HCC. For patients that have disease that may have spread outside of the confines of the liver, if patients have metastatic disease, or they have locally advanced disease that is not amenable to surgery or these regional therapies, patients are eligible for the systemic or targeted therapies. The first biologic or targeted therapy that was shown to be beneficial for HCC was sorafenib back in 2008. And more recently, immune checkpoint inhibitors and other targeted drugs have been found to be beneficial and provide overall survival benefit for patients with HCC.
Now, what unmet needs really remain in this space that you think future research efforts should aim to address?
Well, I think HCC is a cancer that has been difficult to treat in the past. We still have improvements to make in early detection of the disease. And I think we need to better refine how we're going to use the drugs that have been shown to be effective. So many of the drugs that are effective nowadays have been shown to work in the second line setting after something else has failed. And so I think we have to re-examine sort of the paradigm that has been in place in terms of which drugs we use first, which drugs we use second, and now maybe the drugs that we use third. And so I think we might see a sort of reshuffling of how these drugs are being used. And I think that's in our upcoming near future for the management of HCC.
Next, Michael J. Kavnar, MD, Assistant Professor of Surgery at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center, stopped by. Listen on to hear Kavnar discuss the factors that inform treatment interventions for patients with left versus right-sided CRC, multidisciplinary treatment strategies, current approaches for managing liver metastases, and more. Could you highlight the multidisciplinary aspect of care when it comes to treating patients with CRC?
It's a very multidisciplinary field. For many of these patients, they present with some type of abdominal discomfort and pain, and they often are taken care of initially by a general surgeon. They have bowel obstruction or a colorectal surgeon, and some patients during their initial presentation actually need emergency surgery. So that for some of our patients, they come to us through a surgeon, sometimes from an outside surgeon. And in their workup, they're found to have metastases to the liver. And those can either be diagnosed at the same time as their primary tumor, or it can be diagnosed, you know, months to years after their primary tumor is removed. Once it's diagnosed, there's often need to get better imaging. So, you know, maybe the patient had abdominal pain and gets a CT scan, and usually it's a CT scan that's not perfect quality. And so a lot of the time we have to involve our very good radiologists to figure out what the best type of imaging is, whether it's MRI or PET scan or some other imaging modality. From there, we figure out, you know, what is the degree of the disease? You know, is it one small liver lesion or is it 50 liver lesions spread throughout? Is there disease in other places? Whether it's the lungs, which is a common place for colon cancer, lymph nodes, or the lining of the abdomen, which is called the peritoneum. The degree of the disease is variable from one patient to the next. So every patient is different from the others. And so most of these patients go through a multidisciplinary tumor board. And that tumor board, at least for us, is attended by surgical oncologists who do, you know, liver surgery, medical oncologists who give chemotherapy, colorectal surgeons, radiation oncologists who are very involved, particularly for rectal cancer, sometimes interventional radiologists, gastroenterologists. So there's a very wide array of physicians that are involved in taking care of these patients.
How does the surgical management of patients with left versus right-sided CRC tumors differ?
Right side of the colon is the easiest surgical removal. So if someone has a right colon cancer, you know, unless it's very bulky or advanced, that's typically performed laparoscopically. A hospital stay for that type of operation is several days, maybe 3 to 4 days at most. Recovery is typically quick. Left-sided colon cancers, depending on where it is, can be a little bit more complicated. If they are in the upper part of the left colon, what's called the descending or the sigmoid colon, those surgically are fairly straightforward and usually don't involve a diverting ileostomy or any other things like that. But as you get down into rectal cancer, which I guess technically would fall under a sort of left-sided disease, the surgical management gets much more complicated. Those often involve neoadjuvant radiation. Anastomosis is much higher risk and is frequently protected with a diverting ileostomy, which needs another surgery to reverse. So those are the surgical aspects. You know, if a patient just has a primary tumor as their only disease, the surgical aspects are really the dominant factor there, because upfront surgery for primary colon cancer is the standard of care. If the patient has synchronous metastatic disease, meaning they have metastatic disease that is diagnosed at the same time as their primary tumor, then the left versus right-sidedness helps guide the chemotherapy choices. Now, that is an evolving practice, and some of the left versus right differences in response to chemotherapy aren't really mainstream in terms of guidelines. So a typical first-line chemotherapy regimen for either a left or right colon cancer would be something like FOLFOX and Avastin, which both left and right should respond to. If you get into a situation where a patient could not have Avastin for some reason, maybe some cardiovascular issues, then you start looking at adding other biologics. And if it was a left-sided tumor and it was KRAS mutant, that patient would not get an EGFR inhibitor like Erbitux or Panitumumab.
What treatment strategies are typically implemented for patients with CRC who also have liver metastases?
So the standard of care, it really depends on the burden of disease. And so and there's a very wide spectrum of what that means. So let's strictly talk about liver-only metastatic disease. So a patient with, you know, confined to liver metastases. And if there are one or two small lesions, that would be typically managed with some type of, you know, relatively minimally invasive procedure. For example, in my practice, smaller lesions are typically done with a laparoscopic or robotic approach with small incisions, you know, with a 1 to 2 day hospital stay. For almost all metastatic colon cancer, these patients are getting some type of perioperative chemotherapy, meaning chemotherapy that is typically given both before and after surgery. There's some variations of that, but that's fairly standard, and the standard would usually be about 6 months of chemotherapy given both before and after surgery. As you increase the number and complexity of the metastasis, and when I say complexity, I mean involvement of major vascular structures in the liver, involvement of the sort of the amount of liver that's involved, things get more technically complicated. One of the things that I get into that I think is a major advance in liver surgery is this concept of a future liver remnant. It used to be that people thought that essentially to do surgery on the liver, you had to do what's called a major hepatectomy, either a left hepatectomy, which is about 40% of the liver removed, or a right hepatectomy, which is about 60%. Those are major operations, which, you know, 20 years ago carried a 5%+ mortality rate. As the understanding of liver surgery has evolved and the biology of colon cancer, it's now understood that it's not so much about getting a really wide margin, and it's more about taking out the metastasis and leaving as much healthy liver as possible. Historically, major hepatectomies were the majority of surgeries, and now they're the minority. And so for me, for example, I've been at University of Kentucky about 3.5 years, and I've done probably pushing 150 liver resections, and that's probably only about 20 or 30% major hepatectomy.
We were then joined by Prakash Pandalai, MD, Assistant Professor of Surgery and Surgical Oncologist at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center. Listen on to hear Pandalai discuss the developments and management of peritoneal carcinomatosis in CRC. What are some of the challenges that can arise when treating patients with peritoneal carcinomatosis?
This is a devastating disease process that affects far too many patients with colorectal cancer. In particular, peritoneal carcinomatosis is when the primary tumor either perforates or spreads outside of the colon and essentially kind of sheds its tumor cells into the abdominal cavity, often sticking to different layers of the abdominal cavity. So, for example, there's a thin lining known as the peritoneum. It often sticks to that, and other places it can stick are typically organs like the small intestine, the omentum, which is a fatty layer. I often tell patients this is sort of like when you make grilled cheese sandwiches. If you take the bread and you toast the bread and then you melt the cheese on top and put another hot piece of bread on top of that, what it is the cancer cells are the cheese. And so the bread is the lining layers, and it's very difficult to separate the bread and the cheese if you melt them properly, which is unfortunate. And that's often what causes a lot of the morbidity that these patients experience in terms of symptoms of abdominal pain, more often than not, bowel blockages. And so it can often cause significant morbidity in these patients. And unfortunately, we know that systemic chemotherapy is often not that effective at penetrating the peritoneal cavity. And so the fact is that surgery with heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy came about as a way to try and overcome this limitation.
What is the role of cytoreductive surgery and hypothermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy in this patient population?
Historically, CRS, HIPEC, historically when patients with peritoneal carcinomatosis are treated with chemotherapy alone, we know that the outcome in general is a median overall survival that is less than 12 months. when you add aggressive cytoreductive surgery and heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy onto that, the results become much better. And there are single institutional series as well as multi-institutional series that demonstrated overall survival, sometimes as much as 40 to 45 months, which is more than 3.5 years, which is quite profound for these patients. Specifically speaking about the PRODIGE 7 study, that was a wonderful trial that came out of France, recently published in 2018 in abstract form. And this trial was meant to answer the question of what is the value of HIPEC. And so just to step back a little bit again, we talk about CRS HIPEC or cytoreductive surgery and heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy is a sandwich, a combination operation, but it's really two separate procedures. The first procedure is the cytoreductive surgery where we are physically removing all the gross visible tumor that we can see. And often this results in what we call a multivisceral resection or having to remove a small piece of the intestine, a piece of the colon, the appendix, whatever organ or space that we actually see tumor deposits in. And so that's cytoreductive surgery. Once we're done with that, we are hoping not to see any additional cancer cells, but you know, we know that they're hiding somewhere in that abdominal cavity. And so we then actually place these catheters into the abdominal cavity, we sew them in, and we perfuse the abdominal cavity or wash the abdominal cavity for a period of time with chemotherapy that's infused in a heated solution. And so the knock on cytoreductive surgery and heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy is that people question what is the value of each component. And so the PRODIGE 7 study was the first randomized clinical trial to evaluate this particular question. And what they did is they randomized patients to receive cytoreductive surgery. And immediately following cytoreductive surgery, one group would receive heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy and the other group would not. And so they directly assess the impact of the heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy on overall survival. Now, the results of this study are a little bit mixed. If you look at the primary endpoint, which was overall survival, there was no difference in overall survival between either group in terms of the heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy contribution. And the folks that designed this trial were very aggressive. They were looking for an 18-month overall survival benefit, which is quite long. In terms of overall survival for both groups, the median overall survival was equivalent at over 41 months, roughly, which is, you know, phenomenal if you look at that compared to systemic therapy alone. And so I think we have to be very cautious. Some people will look at this trial and interpret this to say there's no additional value to heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy. Others in the field will look at this and say, wow, this promotes an amazing response to good cytoreductive surgery plus or minus heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And these are really the gaps in knowledge.
We closed at the night with Rima Patel, MD, Associate Program Director of the Hematology and Medical Oncology Fellowship, and an Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Medical Oncology at the University of Kentucky. Listen on to hear Patel discuss the importance of the NAPOLI trials and emerging agents coming down the pike in pancreatic cancer. Could you highlight the findings from the NAPOLI trial and their significance in the pancreatic cancer space?
So I think that we saw a couple of key things from this trial. Number one, that patients that are heavily pretreated can still respond to this combination, despite the fact that they've received prior chemotherapy. Usually gemcitabine-based therapy was what they had previously. However, there were some patients that had received irinotecan in their chemotherapy regimens, and albeit not as a robust response, but they still had some response. I think the most impressive thing is that we saw that the progression-free survival was doubled. And although 3.1 months doesn't seem like a lot, I think in the realm of pancreatic cancer, when we can build on progression-free survival, even bit by bit, it's meaningful for this patient population. And they actually had a 45% reduction in risk of progression, which I also think is really important, that, you know, indicates that patients may have longer term disease control than what we've seen in other sort of older trials.
Were any notable findings observed from the subgroup analyses of the Napoli trial?
In terms of the subgroup analysis, there weren't a lot of very exciting things. I think that overall the groups were responding well to the combination arm of liposomal irinotecan and 5-fluorouracil. However, I think the interesting thing is that the patients that received prior irinotecan did not respond as well as other subgroups did. Again, it's hard to use a subgroup analysis and apply it to an entire population, but I think that it gives you some food for thought. And that's part of the reason why when I'm sequencing my therapy in patients, if they've previously been exposed to irinotecan, I don't give them liposomal irinotecan back to back. I like to give another regimen, if tolerable, in between to give them a little bit of break and hopefully allow the patient to respond later on.
Now, Napoli 3 is ongoing, so what can the field expect from that study?
I think that, you know, the early data from ESMO, where they just had a patient population with de novo metastatic pancreatic cancer, is really promising. I mean, a median progression-free survival of 9 months is, you know, what we've seen with overall survival in other trials. So I think that this is going to be a very promising trial. And I think that overall survival is going to be something that we're going to be really eager to see in this patient population and the bigger population study of Napoli 3. I also think that it will be really interesting to see what their disease control rate is, because their best overall response, including stable disease, partial responses, and complete responses in the ESMO study, was actually 81%. So if we're getting disease control rates and best overall response rates that high, I think that will really change what we're doing for frontline for these patients.
What are some agents that are currently in the pipeline and appear particularly promising?
I think one of the other very interesting things that are coming out is how we can utilize immunotherapy in the pancreatic cancer population. Unfortunately, monotherapy has really not panned out. We also know that vaccine trials have not really panned out in pancreatic cancer. So I think that we're starting to learn from the lung population, where they've done sort of conventional chemotherapy with immunotherapy, and they've seen really nice results in that patient population. So I think that combination arms is where we're going to be. There is a study out of Canada looking at actually a mesothelin inhibitor, as well as immunotherapy with a combination of chemotherapy, that I think could be very promising, because now it's using targeted therapy along with immunotherapy. So that could be very exciting. And we actually here at the University of Kentucky are looking at MEK inhibition along with PD-L1 inhibition based on some preclinical data that our clinical scientists have. So I think that's also very interesting to see that we're looking more targeted, especially because we know that a lot of studies recently have been targeting the microenvironment, and those have also not been fruitful. So actually targeting something intrinsic to the cell cycle may prove to be more beneficial for this patient population.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.